VorpalNetwork.com.
This episode of The Tome Show is brought to you by Noble Knight Games, where Out of Print is available again. And listeners like you, thanks for using the Tome's Amazon store.
Hey, this is Elminster Shadowdale, and you're listening to The Tome.
Welcome to The Tome, episode 181. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interview show, and I'm your Tome host, Jeff Greiner.
And I'm Tracy Hurley, and in this episode, we're going to sneak into the palace and fight our way out of it, and fight back in, and sneak back in, and I forget how many times. And then we'll take a bath and blow part of it up, because we're going to look at Bury Elminster Deep. In this episode, we'll be joined by Ed Greenwood, author of the book Bury Elminster Deep. And we're going to be releasing this episode on the same day the book is released, so you can give us a listen and then see if it's something you're interested in.
Mr. Greenwood is going to join us for a short interview, and at the conclusion of the episode, he's going to actually give you a free sample chapter of the book in audio format. He's going to read it for us right here on The Tome Show for all of you.
Awesome. So this is going to come out right before Gen Con, so we wanted to remind you about a few of the Gen Con things that we're doing. First place, if you want to meet us, you can stop by the media meet and greet, have a seat, grab a drink, hang out with some of your favorite bloggers and podcasters, and us. It's at 8 p.m. at the house, which is under Union Station, and we'll be meeting at 7:45 outside the convention center doors that face the Union Station to walk over.
Awesome. I'll be there.
I should be there.
You better be there. Also, be on the lookout for our normal Gen Con seminar and other things coverage. I've talked to some of the guys over at WotC, so I kind of know what they're going to be recording, so I've been able to plan some of what I'm going to record, so there's not too much overlap. I may not catch every single seminar this year, but I'm going to try to focus and hit all the best ones. Of course, that's a subjective term, I suppose, but best according to me, I guess. The one area where I am probably going to overlap with it, Wizards of the Coast, is with the product preview seminar that usually people are very interested in hearing. But to try to add a little bit of something extra to that, we have an interview lined up right after the seminar with some of the guys from WotC, so we'll be able to do some follow-up questions about some of the things they talk about and maybe get a little bit more in-depth details and information about all that good stuff. But beyond that, I'll be running around trying to talk to other people and record as much D&D stuff as possible for the show and any random person I see at Gen Con and whatever. I might even try to get Tracy to help out, but she is pretty busy at the con. We'll see how it turns out. You know, I go to Gen Con as a podcaster. She goes as an internet darling that everybody loves and gets pulled in 1,000 different directions.
I'll be around.
Uh-huh, sure. You know, last Gen Con was the first time we actually met face-to-face, and you were not a co-host of the show at that time.
Right.
Now you are, so your obligations, I think, are significantly higher.
My obligations across the board are significantly higher this year.
They can't be too much higher. You were running games like crazy last year.
Yeah, I had to cut back on some of the games I'm running because I'm on a panel. Fred's on a panel. I have to be lots of places.
For anybody who doesn't know, Fred is her husband.
Yeah. So when my husband gets to be on a panel, I have to be there. It'll be fun.
What's the panel you're on?
I'm on the Dungeon Master Roundtable. We're going to do a live recording of the podcast right at Gen Con, and then we're going to release it later. So that'll be a lot of fun. That's on Saturday. I think it starts at 4. And then Fred's going to be on Care and Feeding of the Freelance Writer, which is going to be interesting, and hopefully he doesn't share too many secrets of mine.
So he's going to do a whole panel about how he supports you doing crazy things like co-hosting podcasts and writing and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's not just him. It's a few other spouses in the industry, but yeah, that's what they're going to talk about. It's how to deal with the strange, crazy people that are freelancers.
You know, it might be easier for him to do that panel if you weren't there.
That's true, so. But then I wouldn't know what everyone knows about me after that. Then it'd be like days afterwards, people would be like, oh yeah, I heard this about you, and I don't know why.
Yeah, that would be awesome. Anyway.
So we should probably talk about the book we're going to be discussing. Before we get into the meat of Elminster Must Die and very Elminster deep. Sorry, let me start that again. Before we get too deep into discussing the current book, Bury Elminster Deep, we should note that this is the second book in a current Elminster series that started with Elminster Must Die, which, okay, spoiler alert, concludes with the death of Elminster. Normally, I don't like seeing spoilers like that, but it's kind of hard to talk about this particular book without talking about the previous one, so we're going to throw some of the caution to the wind in terms of spoiling Elminster Must Die, because there's a lot harder to try to talk about the new book without spoiling the old one. So that's that. You've been warned.
Well, without any further ado, let's get into the interview with Ed Greenwood about Bury Elminster Deep. We are now here with Ed Greenwood. Ed, welcome back to the show, sir.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And we are talking about your newest book called Bury Elminster Deep, the second book in the series. I guess you would call it a trilogy.
Yes, it's either a trilogy or the second of six. I'm not
okay.
Sure.
Right. Following Elminster Must Die.
Yes.
And I have to say, you, without being too spoilery, you don't joke around when you write titles.
No, I don't. No. this was a delightful chance to come up with a title like that. And of course, if you're coming up with a title like that, I mean, readers in our modern day and age are used to being cheated. You know, they're used to being led astray. And I would feel terrible if I was another of the endless herd of people who sort of, you know, misled them or lied to them. No, I mean it. When I say it, I mean it.
So, I mean, obviously, without getting into too much detail or whatever, can you summarize a little bit about what this book is about? What story are you trying to tell?
Bury Elminster Deep? Well, without giving away too many details, I think it's a fairly... It's not selling the farm to tell the reader that, guess what? Elminster is still around. In this book, he's not around the way he was around before the events of Elminster Must Die. Because, something happened to Elminster. Something major. Something that in our real world would be a career ender. Okay? Yeah, he's still around. He's not as he was. And as we'll see, something he's been waiting for almost a century happens. He is delighted, and that's what happens in chapter one. Although the listener should, you know, pay heed to the little details. All may not be as it seems. And this book is about Elminster trying to obey what the goddess he's always obeyed, the aim of his almost his entire life. He's trying to go on doing it. And all of these books are, these later Elminster books, are a bit like, okay, what happens if you're the old quarterback? As in, you were a great quarterback a century ago. Now, get out there and run as fast as the young guys and outthrow them and do it all again. And you know you can't. And you also know that lots of people will be watching you, waiting for you to fall down, waiting for you to slip up, waiting for you to fail. So you've got to fall back on your smarts and manipulating other people, particularly younger people who maybe can run and catch and all the rest. And it's sort of what happens when you try. Now, there's another thing that happens in this book, and we're aiming towards it in the next book, which, of course, I am writing now, that dictates get put upon you that you chafe under. And that happens to all of us in life, but in Elminster, the dictates tend to come from deities. They cannot be ignored. Either you can't do it because you will be forced to follow it, or the consequences will be so dire that you should have just gone along with it anyway. And Elminster is in that difficult position. He's also in the difficult position of the realms have changed a bit. Well, he's been the century of not being a chosen, not having all of those powers, not having access to the weave. So he thinks he knows what he's doing, and he knows that all sorts of little things could have changed, and he mustn't set a foot wrong, and of course he can't avoid setting a foot wrong, and he's sort of making it up as he goes along. So that's what happens in this book. I mean, I'm trying to avoid being chapter and verse specific, but you will see some of Elminster's fellow ex-chosen in the book. You will also see a younger guard, possible successors. Elminster hopes one of them will be a successor, but of course, that makes them, the moment he sort of makes that determination, that paints target all over them for a whole bunch of people.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, there's one old, wheezing, Falstaff-type character who I've had around in the realms from the beginning, who makes a reappearance in these books and is just trying to make his forge a new life for himself in the realms he thought he knew but didn't for a century. So there we are. Ta-da! Clear as mud.
Exactly. And I think it's fair to say that in the conclusion of Elminster Must Die and the opening of Barry Elminster Deep, you sort of give the impression that a lot of this story is going to be focused on some of the old themes of dealing with high magic and the gods and all these things. But in reality, the book spends most of its time dealing with relatively petty politics.
Oh, sure. I mean, the whole point of all of these books is the more time you spend dealing with the gods in person, the more mundane, slash ordinary, slash familiar, slash boring they become. We lose that sense of awe. We lose that mystery. We lose that, oh my goodness, this person could destroy continents, you know, if they want to. What am I doing standing arguing with them? You know, all of that stuff. We lose all that. And so therefore, I don't want to go there too often, number one. And number two, I like writing books about people who are more like you and me. You know, we're trying to make our way through life without screwing up too badly, hopefully. You know, we never quite know exactly what the right thing to do is. We can't read people's minds. We hope we do the best we can. But, you know, we are down at the level of lunch bucket. You know, where is my next meal? Oh, I have to go to the bathroom. Where is the bathroom? You know, the moment you rise above that, you better have a large overarching story to tell that doesn't depend so much on the characters. And what most people do, what most writers do when they're in that situation, George Martin, Terry Goodkind, Robert Jordan, the body count starts to go up because in those great overarching stories, we see characters usually making the ultimate sacrifice or making bloody choices and people dying and so on. And at the moment, I'm not so much interested in that, although there are deaths. My goodness, there are deaths. I'm interested in ordinary people getting through life and the fact that these people who may be superpowered or have been superpowered are pretty ordinary people underneath, and they're dealing with a whole new generation of people who neither know or respect them, who are just ordinary guys, except the ones who are nobles, who are trying to push all the ordinary guys into doing what they want. And I'm also trying to show that human nature is human nature and doesn't change much, and people are as dishonest as they can get away with if there's something in it for them. And I sort of want to sort of burst any balloons that, oh, yes, the great and shining noble kingdom of Cormyr, for instance. Well, it is a great, shining, noble kingdom as compared to the other places in the realms, but, boy, it's not very shining or noble when you're up close, which I guess means the other places in the realms are a little worse. It's all about, you know, getting through life on a daily level. I want to be down at the shoulders of ordinary people as they work their way through life. I do not want to see a battle with 10,000 orcs wiped out in half a page that aren't described. I want to be down in there, right at the shoulder of somebody. That's where I'm more interested in, at the moment, in these books, yes.
Okay. Now, you mentioned some of the characters who are in here or make appearances or what have you. It seems to me that you've found a way to take most of your favorite characters from the pre-fourth edition days and found a way for them to, at least in some way, shape, or form, make an appearance in the post-fourth edition realms.
Yes, it's magic. Actually, when the top secret Kill Before Reading realms meetings were taking place, in which we discussed this possible shift, I at least was very adamant. So what happens to a campaign that's going on in the middle? You know, people should be able to move their characters from one to the other somehow. You know, whether they fall asleep for 1,000 years until, you know, the prince works his way through the thorns and, you know, whatever, kisses the prince or whatever. You know, there should be some way that they can move from one to the other, or we'll lose them all. And therefore, in these books, you see me using two or three different ways that they can last through. And that was quite deliberate. I wanted to show what it felt like for the characters who were put into that situation. So whether they come out of this magic item or whether they've been, you know, frozen in the middle of a portal for almost a century, whatever it is, you know, this is what it feels like, this is what it looks like, and this is where you are now, oh joy. When everybody you loved is dead and gone. Right. You don't owe anybody anything anymore. That's one good thing. Ooh, your home is gone, or probably somebody else has it. Ooh, that's a bad thing. You know, and so on and so forth. You know, what it's like.
Yeah, and it seemed that the book helped. I know there was, for a while, there was a big controversy of, if you have characters at this level, why do you need any PCs in the world at all? And this book, I think, does show some ways of doing that, mm-hmm. without them necessarily always just being the hand puppets of
the higher-ups. You see, that point about, well, what do you need player characters for if you have these people running around, I could never quite see that. I could understand it if you were reading a comic, like, oh my goodness, so somebody attacks New York, well, if Spider-Man's going to fight him, you have to get the Fantastic Four off in one direction, you have to get the Avengers off in another direction, so they're not there. I understand that level. I never understood it in the realms, because my home player characters are played by people who never ever play like that. It's always heavy-duty role-playing. They're acting out. Everybody is a part of the world, you know, high and low, and everything's always going on. And the sort of big, powerful players on either side, evil, good, whatever, are usually off somewhere else doing something else. You know, there are ways you could attract their attention. Let's show up and, you know, blow up Elminster's tower. Mm-hmm. Let's keep on blowing it up until he shows up. Yeah, I mean, you could do that if you desperately wanted to. But, you know, as a dungeon master, I'd be staring at you, scratching my head and saying, you want to do this? Why? You've got, like, continents out there full of dragons or something, and you want to go and pull this old guy's beard. Why, exactly? You have a death wish? Okay. I can take care of that for you. You know, but, I mean, it would be like, why would you want to do that? The point is, the realms is so vast, and there's so much going on, that you never, ever have to even bump into. They'd be the sort of thing that you hear about in gossip in the marketplace or in a tavern or around a campfire.
Yeah, I gotta say, anytime I run a Realms campaign, Elminster oftentimes makes cameo appearances.
Yes.
But once the characters have met him once, it was so frustratingly entertaining, they never want to go back and do it again.
Exactly. Yeah. That's the best way to do it.
Yeah.
And, of course, you can do it other ways, too, where you call on them and ask on them for advice, and you get the voice through the door sort of thing. And after they turn away from the door, the door pops open, and the guy comes out and says, "Oh, whew," shifts over, and the next guy goes in and says, "Your turn to be Elminster." Okay, goes back in. Wait a minute. You can do all sorts of things like that.
Well, and you actually highlight at the end of Bury Elminster Deep a little bit of some reasons why maybe these, you know, mighty and powerful chosen of Mistra or whatever may not help you out or may not get involved. I mean, there's a very specific point of, you know, how is this horrible thing allowed to happen? And it's, you know, explained away pretty thoroughly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Many people sort of had this passing idea, particularly if they're not really into the realms, that the Chosen of Mistra are good and they are against the bad guys. And of course, that conveniently ignores the fact that Mistra's aim is to spread the use of magic, period. So she's against magical tyrants, like, for instance, many of the upper-level Red Wizards of Fey, because they oppress other people trying to use magic, as in, they kill them. You know, and she's not too hot on, you know, archwizards who go around killing other users of magic. Archwizards who go around coercing them into being their servants slash good allies slash workers, that's okay, because Mistra's all about making sure the use of magic spreads throughout the world. So eventually, you know, every little toadstool, every little two-year-old crawling will have some magical abilities. Eventually. That's Mistra's heading towards that long view. She doesn't care so much about, oh, this guy is the most powerful magician and he's evil. You know, yeah, so as long as he doesn't oppress people by controlling magic, he can oppress people other ways. That's none of her affair. It's when he or she tries to cut down on the use of magic, which is, of course, why the institution of the Magister was created by Mistra, the gunslinger. You know, there's always somebody around to challenge you. Wham! Oh, good, took care of that tyrant. I won't be that bad. And, of course, the scenes in some of my past novels where you see Elminster and other people wandering around putting scrolls, magical scrolls, in tombs and so on for other people to find. You ever wonder why, you know, as your adventurers wander through this dungeon, there's these piles of treasure and magic items around? I mean, why are they there? Wouldn't somebody else have taken them first? Well, it's because in some part of it is because Chosen of Mistra and Harpers and other people who, acting under their orders or at their suggestions, leave these things here for other people to find. I mean, it's a little far-fetched, but somebody should come up with some explanation for why all these dungeons are full of all this crap lying around. It's like, you know, surely the nearby peasants would all go in there together and grab whatever coins they could, because it's more money than they'll ever see in their lives. So it's worth it. Lose a few peasants, everybody else is rich. You know? Why didn't they do that? Well, obviously, either it's too dangerous, in which case there should be lots and lots of half-devoured peasants and bones and stuff, or the remains hanging out of various traps, which there might be, or somebody's putting the stuff back. Or substituting other stuff, and that's one of the things that the Chosen do. So yeah, it's there should never be a power imbalance, although I can understand from watching some people, the way they role play, some people are in it to build the most powerful character. Some people stop in the middle of play and they don't role play, they don't act at all. They say, okay, the thief is going to attack from behind, well, you fireball and I'll come around. They sound like a football quarterback in the huddle. You know, you do this, and I'll sneak around the back. That's perfectly okay to do it in character before the fight, but they do it during the fight, as if the orcs or the brigands they're fighting won't hear them and go, oh, he's going to run around the back. Okay, I'm ready. You know, there are ways of playing it where it's all about winning, but that's never interested me. If I want to do that, there were lots and lots of cool board games around before Dungeons & Dragons came, and I own some of them. You know, I can play that every night. I'm more interested in its role-playing, in the ham-acting thing. You know, and some people ridicule that, but that's mainly because they've sat next to a 500-pound hairy guy with a beard going, oh, my lord, I'm the elven princess, play cozy up to me. And it just doesn't work, you know? Everybody else at the table goes, ugh, okay. but that's also because everybody else at the table isn't buying into that style of play, you know?
Speaking of cozying up to people.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I've read all the Elminster books.
Yes.
And I think this book probably has more sex in it than all the rest of them.
It does?
Or maybe I wasn't paying as close of attention.
You see, I can never remember how much sex got left in.
Uh-huh.
And that's because for years, I used to write sex scenes for all of them, knowing that the editors would cut them out. But also knowing the editors would, with great glee, stand up in their chairs in cubicle land in the old TSR and begin to read the sex scene aloud for the edification and amusement of everybody laboring in the cubicles all around them. And then they would say, ha ha, Ed, that's nice. We're never going to use that. Toss it over the shoulders. And it would depart the book. You know, so I can't remember which ones made it in and didn't make it in, you know, but
did you try to wear them down so that way leave some in?
Well, yes and no. You see, the thing is, when I started The Realms, I wasn't writing it for any publisher. I was writing it for me. And I was doing the National Geographic thing. You know, the Native women have long floppy breasts. I merely report this fact. You know, that's the National Geographic approach to things. And it was a quote, real, unquote, world. You know, I wanted people to be born and die and have issue and so on, and when you had to go to the bathroom, the stuff went somewhere. You know, I worked it all out, and including all the sex and the fact that you know, one of the largest triggers in both literature and in The Realms is fights over love. You know, whether it's Romeo and Juliet, you know, that sort of thing, the dynastic struggles, and the fact that you have to be very careful if you have children. And you are royal, because, you know, the more bastard offspring there are around, the more pretenders or potential usurpers for the throne, the more drama can go on. So, of course, I'm always thinking about stuff like that. So, I had sex in the realms from the beginning. And, of course, what it really came down to is the published realms was how much of it do we chop out, which was a lot, because the original thrust, to use an inappropriate word, of the TSR published realms was it was supposed to be for 12-year-old American males. And as a Canadian, this left me scratching my head at times. It was like, so these 12-year-old American males can take infinite amounts of gorily described violence, but you can't talk about the fact that we have breasts? Okay. But I gradually sort of came to understanding what you could and couldn't do. And in the early Realms books, there's a lot of, oh, I don't know, ladies forgetting to have their clothes on in the scene. You know, and that's sort of like shorthand for sex that we're not talking about, you know. And over the years, I think all of the Realms writers have broadened the horizons. I mean, Bob Salvatore in the Graduation that occurs, I believe, in Homeland, the head of the female graduating class, she conjures up a demon and has sex with it. And it's like, whoa, I never got to do that in my book. But I mean, over the years, we have always added in a little bit more and a little bit more. And I have usually had editors taking stuff out. In recent books, I was actually asked to sex things up a bit, which usually meant I added a lot more in and they just chopped it back out again. And that's okay with me, as long as the story ends up making sense. You know, we can all leave things at the bedroom door, unless what happens in the bedroom is integral to the story.
Mm-hmm.
And it usually isn't. You know, you can do pillow talk and so on, and frankly, I don't think there should be any holds barred. But on the other hand, any storyteller is editing. I mean, if you wrote a story, a short story, that involved, you know, character X getting up in the morning, and you described in wearying detail character X going to the bathroom, brushing their teeth, putting on their clothes after they select which ones to go on, you know, going downstairs, plugging in the coffee, you know, when do we get to the story, you know?
Right.
So you're always editing stuff out. And we are in the TSR and now later Wizards of the Coast Realms novels are neither romances nor porn or nor erotica. That's not what we're writing. We're writing action-adventure stories. There should always be an element of spice, but how much it is or how little it is up to the editor and the writer, you know, and what they're aiming for in that story. So, yeah, I add in sex, but that's no more than has always been there. What you get to see in the published books is what survived.
Okay. So maybe Wizards of the Coast assumes a little bit more of a mature audience than they used to for your books.
I guess.
Okay.
I mean, you'd have to ask them, but yeah, there's still some things got edited out.
I guess the book has a lot of suggested sex in it.
Sure.
More than,
well,
no.
Just to give you an example of something that got edited out of Elminster Must Die. You might remember a scene in Elminster Must Die where this little guy pays a visit to her, to Amaroon, to her window, uh-huh, in the middle of the night. And he wants to hire her to forge something, to counterfeit something. Do you remember that?
Vaguely.
Yeah, okay. Well, when I first wrote the scene, he shows up at her window, and she's going, oh, all right, you know. And then he wants to pay her another copper piece or another silver piece so he can fondle her breasts, because he can't, you know, get the company of a woman very often.
Sure.
And this is a normal transaction between them, you know. He hands over the money, and she goes, okay. And she draws her dagger and stands there ready in case he fondles a little bit further. The dagger will come down and pin his hand to the table. He doesn't, you know. And on they go with their transaction. And, of course, the editor sort of looked at that and said, nope. And it just disappeared. And it just disappeared in the first edit.
And
I didn't try and put it back in. I said, okay, fine. You know. And I was. You see, what I was doing in that was not, it wasn't described. The actual fondling wasn't described. What I was doing was telling the reader a bit more about Amaroon and how much she's willing to do. She's just trying to get by in life. Okay, he's going to pay me more money? Fine. You know? And on the other hand, I'm showing you how desperate and down a heel this guy is. You know? And he's so eager and delighted. Someone who will let him do this. Here, I'll pay. You know? And I'm showing you more about both the characters, just in a few sentences. And yet, it is neither germane to the overall thrust of the story, and nor did it fit what the editor wanted in there, so it went. And that's okay.
Yep. Speaking of Amaroon, in the first book, she was described as a fairly accomplished thief.
Yes.
In the second book, most of those skills never really come up because of the circumstances of what's going on.
Yes.
Are we going to see her sort of back in action in the next book?
Yes, she's going to be back in action. No, not so much the thieving stuff. See, here's the problem. A twofold problem. A writer's problem in that you've now got all this stuff going on, okay? And you've got this Lord Delcastle always at her side, you know, swashing his buckle, okay? You have Elminster. You have other people, you know. There's lots of opportunity for hacking and slashing and blasting and running like hell. There's not so much opportunity for thieving skills other than picking locks, you know, and getting through a door in a hurry or moving quietly, you know. People just don't get the chance, and that includes Amara. That's number one. The number two thing is, from her point of view, she wasn't. She was good at what she did. She liked being very capable. She liked the how famous she'd made the Silent Shadow. Okay, she liked the reputation, but it's dangerous. She's doing it in order to eat, you know, to get by. If she doesn't have to, and she largely doesn't have to after she's sort of hitched to Lord Delcastle, because, you know, she can always show up at his place for a meal, you know. So why do it? Particularly after a seemingly ever slowly, ever widening circle of people tend to either know or suspect that she's the Silent Shadow, you know. That makes it harder and harder for her to get away with things. And she doesn't see any need to get away with things, or she doesn't have time to get away from things. So, as the third book stands now, she gets a lot of action in, but not too much of it is thiefly action. Yet. You see, that's the thing. I can describe thieving expeditions, heists, whatever, if the plot calls for them. But as these first three books keep on torquing up the whirlwind of politics in Cormyr. You know, there's all these nobles running around knifing each other. There's these fights in alleyways. There's people calling each other out. There's hired wizards being used. You know, it would almost stop the whirlwind action dead to do a nice thieving scene, if you see what I mean. The other thing is that you know, it's Amaroon is changing in front of our eyes because she's being jolted out of the life she had. I mean, we saw that at first in the first book. You know, when she goes home and she's absolutely dog tired and she flakes out and all her dirty clothes and underwear on the floor rises up. There's Elminster. Hi, I got to talk to you. You know, come with me. You know, and it's like, I don't want to. What's going on? You know, but I mean, she's being forced into changes in her life and she's obviously being invited to undertake a role in life she doesn't want to particularly take on. But everything's changing for her, too. So we may or may not get to see her doing her thing as a thief. That's the thing. Aside from when I wrote The Kingless Land at the request of Brian Thompson for Tor Books, I don't go around writing books in which I say, oh, this is the wizard, this is the cleric or priest, this is the thief, and this is the fighter. You know, it's sort of like, these are these people, these characters, and this is what happens to them, and they do what they have to do. Or they do what they think is right, or they try and do something, you know, and they may or may not fit what we expect them to do, or what they themselves expect to do. I mean, because I want to see people changing, I want to see people challenged. Life is a series of choices. Good fiction is usually a series of moral choices, challenges, and how the characters react to them. So. Yeah, Amaroon may get around to doing some thieving. It depends on how things go. In the first three books, it doesn't look like she gets to do much of it because there are too many bodies falling, or castle walls falling, or dragons falling, or wizards falling right past her nose and landing splat right beside her. You know, she just isn't getting the chance to pick a lock and relieve somebody of their purse when it's the middle of a pitch battle and they're running at top speed. But I'll work on it. If you want to see it, I'll work on it.
Very good. Tracy, do you have any more questions before we have him read a chapter?
I just want to say I could definitely see the generational issues. I know we talked about that a little earlier in the book, particularly when Lord Dalcastle talks to, I believe it's his mom.
Mm-hmm.
And she's just explaining, like, I can understand how when I was your age, I probably would have thought similarly. But now you've got to see it from our viewpoint. And I kind of feel like that's almost a conversation that's happening across people who enjoy these types, who enjoy these novels and who enjoy the game and stuff like that, too, right now. That's all.
Oh, sure. I think you're right. I think it is. And you're going to see Lord Delcastle's mom change even more in the third book. Everybody's changing.
She seemed to be a much nicer person than I expected her to be from everything we'd heard about her before.
Well, you see, the thing is, what we see at the beginning in the first book, we see her reacting to her husband being a total drunkard and, you know, wastrel and so on, you know, and her reacting to her son being himself, which is a lippy teenager. You know, and he is scornful of the way she behaves, and he is playing the dandy. I mean, he's not by any means gay, but he's effeminate in these sort of la di da, lace at my wrist, prance a long way, and it's the typical thing. It has nothing necessarily to do with a fantasy setting or nobility or whatever. It's each new generation challenges their parents and their parents' views and their parents' styles and fashions and music and everything. And each set of parents goes, oh, my Lord, where did we go wrong? Or they say, oh, the young these days, oh, you know, how can you listen to that? How can you? You're not going out of the house dressed like that, you know. And, of course, the two of them have just been going at each other, hammer and tongs. But that's the situation they've settled into. And what we see in the first book, and then increasingly in this book, is everything's shaken up. You know, the Lady Merentine, for the first time, sees her son as somebody capable who's doing something. You know, he's not spending all his time reciting poetry and getting drunk with his friends at the pub and, you know, sneering down his nose at people around. In other words, being a wastrel. In other words, heading the way his father was. You know, drinking far too much, doing nothing, being idle. You know, she starts to see him as doing things decisive. Whether she agrees with him or not is another thing, but she's seeing him through new eyes. Oh, my goodness, this is my son, you know, sort of thing. And what she thought she knew of the Cormyr, the way the nobility works, is shaken up, too. You know, so she's being forced to change, too. Everything's changing, you know. And she has this instinctive reaction to Amarun the first time, you know. Amarun is mooted. Oh, another little doxy you've brought home. Uh-huh. I suppose you're going to, you know, make love to her over there and stain my best couch. You know, and it's sort of it's the acidic dismissal, you know. And then, you know, later on, Amarun comes to her in fear and anguish, and she's viewing Amarun in new eyes. This is someone who obviously loves my son, and she's not a pushover. She's not fawning, you know, she's not sitting down to have tea with me and try and worm her way into my good graces, you know. So you see Lady Merentine changing the way she acts, too. Everybody is, you know, it's putting everybody under pressure and seeing how they react.
And there's also a little lesson there of, you know, sometimes you better listen to your parents because they know what they're talking about.
There's a lot of that. and there's even more in the second book, and there's even more in the third, although the third gets away from the nobility. But yeah, in the third you'll get to see some people who aren't noble and yet have to deal with nobles every day. Okay, so there's a lot more of the, oh, go and clean the horse, lad, and I'll deal with Lord so-and-so. You know, there's a lot more of that. And you'll get to see it from their side. But yeah, it's all about characters in these books. And it's all about every little person gets a little moment to shine. And that's one of the things that the ongoing battle between me and editors in all sorts of publishing companies. I don't like books where 500 guards get strangled and fall over dead, and we go on. Or, you know, 5,000 Nazi stormtroopers cartwheel past you after the bomb goes off, and you just see bits and pieces of them thud to the earth, and that's it. I want you to know that each one of those guys had a wife and kids at home, da 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 da, and what he wanted to do in life, you know, da da da. But now I guess that we've blown him apart. He'll never be the great violinist he was going to be. You know, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm.
Although, it does end up creating a bit of a cast of thousands, and sometimes it gets hard to remember who's who.
Sure.
It seems like at the end of this book, it's moving to a larger, more higher arcing story.
Yes.
Does that seem to be accurate? Because the first book actually felt that at the end of the first book felt that way too, and then you fooled me.
I fooled you.
You got me. Is that the direction you're going though? Is it going to be a larger arcing with maybe a smaller cast or?
Yes and no.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah. Each book widens the story, but it doesn't so much widen what's happening. It widens our viewpoint. We pull back and see more that we couldn't see before. Okay? Mm-hmm. Each of these, this first three new Elminster books, or Elminster in fourth edition, whatever. You know, Elminster starting in the year of the Aegis One in the spring. These three books, they keep pulling back, showing us how wider in scope this is becoming. And yes, the focus widens from the beginning of Elminster Must Die, when we're basically seeing Elminster and Storm together, and then people coming at them. It keeps widening until we see, oh my goodness, there's this council. Oh my goodness, it's all the nobles in Cormyr. Oh my goodness, it's all the commoners and how they're affected by the nobles. Oh my goodness, oh, there's something else going on. You know, and I keep widening it and widening it. But I don't want, at the same time as I'm widening the tale, I am not only killing off people, characters, but I am trying to keep it the focus tight to one point of view at a time, and a small select points, a number of points of view. That's what you're quite right that it becomes a cast of thousands. And there are times when I've tried to do this, like Julian May did in her Ecclesian Exile books, where there are literally 60 or 70 viewpoint characters. Now, this is not something that editors of game-related novels tend to like. They tend to like a smaller compass. And there are good reasons for that. I mean, I'm not disputing their reasons. I still try and tell it my way first. And then we revise the book and do a final draft that is more what they're looking to publish. Because I want to see how the story works when told from different points of view. One of the things I've always loved doing, and this is something I learned as a little kid listening to science fiction writers talk about John Campbell, who was the famous editor of Astounding. You know, John Campbell would, which is still around as Analog, and he would get oodles of stories from people, first contact stories, you know, for the alien and the first alien and the first Earthman meet on the asteroid, you know, and they fire at each other or whatever. And he'd throw the story back and say, yeah. Now tell it from the point of view of the asteroid. And, of course, I sometimes feel like I want to do that. In the middle of a barroom brawl, a tavern brawl, where we've got, you know, in this case, Lord Delcastle, with his sword out, hacking away in all directions. You have Amaroon, you know, doing the acrobatic thing, getting behind the bar, throwing bottles and all this stuff, doing the tumbling. I would love it to be just one of the maids who was serving table, and she shrieks and goes under the table because she doesn't want to get killed. And what it's like from her point of view, you know, just for a moment. But, of course, editors don't tend to like that because they don't want you to shift point of view. I would love to tell the same thing, the same battle, the same confrontation from three or four different points of view. And, for instance, if you go back to some of my earlier Elminster books and Crown of Fire and so on, we had huge confrontations between Storm and Elminster and Manchun and Beholders and so on. And I would love to have switched into the head of one of the Beholders for a few seconds and told a bit of the thing from their point of view, and then switched out and gone into Manchun's head, you know, because then you can see what everybody's trying during the fight, how far they think it can go. But of course, like as I said, editors usually want things to be more straight ahead. They don't want that, you know. So they aren't too happy when people do things like that. So we have an editor, and a thing where the editor and I have to go at each other and decide what the final shape of the thing should be, which usually means my other points of view go away, unfortunately. But, I mean, I like to try it.
Sure.
As a writer, you're always trying different things. You know, and I'm, what is this? This is like novel number 40-ish something and book number 180-something-ish for me. So I've been doing it for a while, but I still do things differently all the time. You never stop learning. You never stop trying things differently because otherwise you get dead bored, you know, writing the same book. I could quite happily sit down if I was just interested in the money and write 6 thrillers a year that are carbon copies of each other, you know. And then, you know, Mach Zero, the secret agent, rolled out of bed with the Russian agent, just like he did in the last book. You know, you know, but they would get boring quickly for me, and it would show in the writing. You know, so I'm always trying to do different things. At the same time, when I'm writing a realms book, I'm always trying to set up 20 or 30 little loose ends or events or people that other people can use or that might come back. And quite often, my fiercest fights with an editor is when I get up against somebody who says, well, why is this in the story? It doesn't advance the story. And I said, yeah, I'm thinking 6 books ahead. You know, and they're going, well, you know, it shouldn't be here if it doesn't advance the story.
Well, in that case, I have to insist that you start writing the books faster.
Well,
a year is a long time between books to remember what happened in the last one. If you're going 6 books ahead, we need to get these all together.
Well, I usually write 4 books a year, but I don't write them all for Wizards of the Coast,
right?
Because they only want to publish 1 Elminster book a year. So after I finish this one, I will be writing a steampunk book, which I will have to finish by Christmas. So, you know, yeah. I'm still writing them at top speed, but I don't think Wizards will publish them at top speed. You see, that's where spinning yarn comes in. That's where I get to have fun.
Mm-hmm.
But I would love to write, say, 4 Realms books a year. It might kill me, but I would love to do it because when it's the Realms, I've always got umpteen ideas floating around
sure.
that I would really like to get to. And literally hundreds of ideas that have built up that I've scribbled down since we started working on the realms. I mean, there are tons and tons. I never wanted to write, say, Elminster novels. You know, that was the publisher's idea to have signature characters. I think if you talk to Bob Salvatore, he would love to write, say, a Wolfgar novel that doesn't have Dresden in it at all. Right?
Mm-hmm.
But that's not what the publisher's looking for. See what I mean? That's and think of that particular frustration times 50, because I created the realms. I've got all these characters I want to write books about. I want to write Merton Durnan novels when they're the thinking man's Conan Durnan. And Mert is a much younger, still fat and wheezing, but much younger guy who actually can get out of the second floor window when the husband comes home. You know, rather than the way he is now, you know. And there are tons of different characters I'd like to pick up on and write about. And there just isn't the opportunity. So, yeah, I would love to write lots more of books. And, yeah, but you see, here's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to go back and read all the preceding ones. This is what I used to do each time Roger Zelazny brought out a new Amber book. I bought it. I ran home. I read the dust jacket. I carefully took the dust jacket off. And then I put the book away, and I read all the Amber books again, up to that one. And only then did I allow myself to read the new one, knowing I had a whole year to... Now, even better, you should buy them all over again each time. So I can, you know, have my kidney-shaped swimming pool full of, you know...
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've got too many unread books on my shelf to go back and reread them all over again.
Oh, no, you see, you're not approaching this in the right way. You should approach this in the IKEA way. Those books... They are not books. They are a new side table. Go to IKEA, buy a lamp, put it on top of the pile. There you go. Excellent. Move on. Start a new pile.
Very good.
Those aren't the important books.
That's right. Yeah. Unless my books are in that pile, none of those books are important.
Very good.
You're talking to a man who is sitting in the middle of 80,000 books in his home.
Yeah.
Pile on all sides.
I still never got around to reading the your new version of what was it, the Spellfire books that used to be one book and then you expanded it out to a trilogy.
Well, it's like this.
I read the original, but I haven't gone back and read the trilogy yet because I have so many other things to read.
Right. Okay. Well. Okay. Crown of Fire, the new one,
mm-hmm.
is identical to the old Crown of Fire. Identical.
Okay. Uh huh.
Not a word changed. The original Spellfire, I rewrote. And then it had to be shortened by somebody in-house. Nobody told me this beforehand. So what they told me is if I added a word, I had to take a word out, so it ended up the same length. What they didn't tell me is they were then going to cut about 11,000 words, 16,000 words, whatever, from it. So somebody else did that. So when it says revised and expanded, well, no, it's not. It's shorter. And the third book is brand new. Okay?
Okay.
But... If you don't have time to read, that's okay, because that's now in the past.
I'll get to it eventually.
Okay, okay. Well, there's this thing called sleep. It's overrated.
Yeah. I've got a one-month-old baby, so I understand the lack of sleep.
Ah,
yes.
Yeah.
He's going to Gen Con to get sleep.
Yeah.
Ah, well, that's a great idea.
Yeah.
And there's this thing called boarding school. And up in Canada, we have junior forest rangers. You have to wait until they're like, I don't know, 15 or something like that. And then you ship them up north, and they can't get back unless they can walk through about 3,000 miles of dense bush. See, for the whole summer, you sleep.
I'm just going to send them to your house, then you can raise them.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, okay, there's the other... Oh, no, I forgot. There are all these laws now. You see, my parents could still put me in the back corner of the garden, chained to an anvil, leave the back door open and food on a table. I'm like sweating and straining and cursing and pulling. I could just get in the back door by the time they got home. Perfect. But you can't do any of that stuff anymore.
No. Anyway, I think we're a little bit off topic. Do you have any other last thoughts you wanted to share about Barry Elminster Deep?
Yes. There are other people from the past that are going to make an appearance in books to come, and you already know about a certain gentleman whose name begins with M.
Uh-huh.
His tale is not done, and it should be obvious by the end of this book that certain things aren't quite right. Certain things aren't quite right with the great delight that Elminster discovers, and certain things aren't quite right with Manshun's sanity.
Mm-hmm.
So they're both leading places. And I will leave you with just one word as a clue. Manipulation is that word. And so on.
Very good. And that was the unimitatable Ed Greenwood. Before we get into our thoughts on the book, let's mention our sponsor, Noble Knight Games, a game store that also has an online store with great discounts, and they have a knack for finding the long out-of-print game products that you've been looking for. Our pick for this episode is Elminster Ascending, a collection of the first three Elminster books that describe his how he sort of became a chosen of the goddess of magic and how that relationship occurred, his role in establishing the power of the elves in the Forgotten Realms, and then their eventual fall in the city of Mithranor, and a story about temptation that kind of shows his true character of a hero because he, you know, as you could probably guess, how he sort of staves off that temptation to go down the dark road and be corrupted. These three books helped introduce me to Elminster as a person. We'd always sort of had him in cameos throughout lots of books for a long time in the realms, or little introductions and things in game books and what have you. But this was our first chance to really find out who this guy was and where he came from and what he was all about. And you can get all three of these books full of high magic and spell hurling and world shattering events for $13 for Noble Knight Games.
Noble Knight Games has been serving the needs of thousands of gamers worldwide since 1997. With a huge selection of over 30,000 unique products, including discounts on most in-print games of up to 50% off or more. Noble Knight Games is the place for out-of-print RPGs, board games, war games, collectible card games, miniatures, and all things game-related. They ship worldwide and will purchase or trade your titles you no longer need, new, or used. Your satisfaction is guaranteed. Just visit www.noblenight.com or visit our website for direct access to thousands of new, out-of-print, and in some cases, one-of-a-kind items.
So now I guess we should talk about the book with just the two of us for now.
Now that we're not being listened into by the author and what have you?
Yeah. So what did you think?
I have the advantage in that I've read all of the Elminster books at this point, whereas I'm guessing this is your first Elminster book?
Yes.
And you actually came into a trilogy in the second book, having not read the first,
right.
Which I imagine is a fairly unique experience. I found the book, it opened really strong, it closed really strong. There was about 10 chapters or so towards the beginning that I thought hit a bit of a lull. And there are times that I still go back and I have a hard time sort of figuring out what the plot is, you know, where they're going and what the main story here and what they're trying to accomplish is.
Right.
But that said, the individual little parts in the middle and the events and the dialogue and all that kind of stuff I found really interesting. I think he got a little bit more into the nobles stuff than I probably would have liked. But I also feel like I sort of came to a revelation that I think if I think of these characters like characters in, say, a Doctor Who story, then it sort of starts coming together and making sense, because just like in a good Doctor Who story, they're running around and everything's chaotic and you have no idea what's going on, and then at the end it all sort of comes together and it all suddenly makes sense. And I think,
right.
I think that's a little bit of what's going on here. And at the end, in the last book, it's all going to come together and suddenly make sense.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, so it's pretty common, I think, in trilogies that the middle book helps set up the end of the book. Like, it does that transition. So sometimes I've found, because this isn't the first trilogy in general that I've read, that I've often found that happening in the middle.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
I've read other books where I've come in, like other series where I've come in the middle of a series, and have been able to read the book pretty easily without knowing what's come before.
Mm-hmm.
I think you can do this. I know my reading slowed down a lot.
Mm-hmm.
My pace was much slower with this book than in general when I read. And that's because, I mean, Ed Greenwood makes very detailed, rich worlds, I think. So,
yeah, he does. And I don't know if it's, I mean, I think depending on what you're looking for, it can be a positive or a negative, right? There are little things that happen that if he stuck to one perspective, you know, if he just stuck to the perspective of the heroes, it would be, oh, and then this beholder shows up. You know, and then maybe you would get a little explanation later on through the events. Whereas the way Ed Greenwood does it all is he changes perspective completely and gives you this whole detailed background of where that beholder came from and how he ended up in that part of town.
Right.
You know? And so, yeah.
I tend to enjoy, but it does make it harder if the book isn't written to also be a standalone book, which I don't think this one necessarily, like, it didn't feel that way to me. Mm-hmm. It can make it sometimes harder because I'm not only trying to figure out what these details are for the first time, because, like, you've read enough books by now that I think a bunch of the details you kind of already know a little bit about.
Sure.
Where they're all new to me, so that's all I would say about it. But I still think it was, you know, a good read and everything, and I enjoyed it.
Are you a Doctor Who watcher?
Yeah, my husband's a huge fan.
So did you get my analogy, though, how it sort of feels like they're just running around like it's chaos all over the place, and then somehow it's all going to come together into a plan?
Right. And I don't want to spoil too much. It's kind of strange, though, because the plan kind of changes, too, as it goes along.
Well, but everybody's does. Like,
right.
That's the thing, is that the first book, there was at least one of the characters, the villain, Manchun, had a very specific plan. And he manipulated things, and all of his machinations came together, and it ended the way he wanted to. Elminster was killed.
Right.
Yay, Manchun. Step one of his plan is done, because he meticulously planned it out. And then in the second book, all of a sudden, he throws his plan out the window on a whim. You know, it's like, oh my gosh, I have a chance to go over here. Well, I'm going to go set up shop over there, or I'm going to go hide my things over there. You know, and so even he, who was super meticulously planned out in the first book, the plan gets completely thrown out the window just to sort of sow chaos and cause problems in hopes that he turns out better for it, it seems.
Right.
And everybody's sort of in that plan. And I also feel like, again, because of this really rich, sort of detailed situation that Ed Greenwood likes to get into, and I think in these books more so than in the previous Elminster books, the majority of this book takes place over the course of what, 2 days? I mean, that's how much detail he's going into. Is that he's going into all these different perspective of what's going on in different parts of the city and whatever, and you read 28 chapters that covers about 2 days worth of time.
Yeah, I have to admit, I lost track of time at some point because I don't know.
Well, and as we sort of joked about in the intro, within those 2 days, they sneak in and out of the palace of Cormyr like 4 or 5 times.
Right.
and half the time, you're not even entirely sure why they're going there other than they don't have anything better to do.
Yeah.
So, I think you get a lot of good detailed world and setting and characters and all that kind of stuff. I thought there was a lot of characters going on into it.
Were a lot.
I think it would have helped me if I had read the first book and then immediately gone into the second book, because the first book helps set up some of these characters that I had sort of forgotten a little bit about over the last year.
Right.
Since I read it. But that said, I do really like the main characters, the heroes of this story. Now, I'm curious because in our first book club episode, you were concerned in the Erebus Kale trilogy because there wasn't a real strong female presence. Ed Greenwood, however, is known for writing pretty strong female presences.
Mm-hmm.
Was that good or bad?
I liked it, although... Okay, so... One thing about the Wheel of Time series that, like, it was great. There was a lot of strong female characters in it, but a lot of them were very similar. Like, maybe it's just that they put their hair over their right shoulder instead of the left. I know that's not exactly what it is, but that's sometimes how it feels like to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like there wasn't enough difference between the female characters other than maybe Storm, right?
Well, yeah. I sort of feel like there were two main female characters, although I suppose you could argue there were several. But yes, right. Storm is the one that like Elementor, a former chosen of Mistra.
Right. And she's the one that's very self-confident compared to some of the other ones.
Yes.
And then there was Galathra? I forget how to pronounce her name.
Yeah. The war wizard who kind of takes over when all the other leaders in the palace are gone.
Right. And she was okay. It's sometimes just got a little old. For me,
mm-hmm.
like other people might like it, but sometimes for me it got a little old having the constant rolling of the eyes and.
I got to a point with Galathra that I think we're supposed to not like her. Obviously, I mean she's kind of a
right
a strong-headed person. We'll say
yeah.
And I got to the point where I was starting to say, man, I really just wish the stupid royal magician would come back because they're always more reasonable, They're always more experienced and know that, when people like Elminster or Storm show up, you don't just assume that they're the bad guy and go after him. You give him the benefit of the doubt, you talk to him or whatever, because I'm just kind of getting sick of all this.
But
just about at that time that I was starting to really get sick of it, that's when the royal magician came back. So
is that a spoiler?
Maybe a little bit, I guess. I mean, in the Royal Magician was incapacitated in the first book, so I think anybody who's read the first book knows the situation and that eventually they're going to come back, right?
For me, it's just overall the whole, almost just kind and some of the other male characters are kind of cads and they appreciate the female form, which is awesome and cool. but the 50th time I've read it in the same book, it just gets to me a little old. That's all. And I mean, I don't know. I just feel like I'm complaining. And
I think what you'll notice is some of the characters behave a certain way. Like you're talking about, and have really sort of odd behaviors. Elminster is one of them. I think one of them that you're talking about is Mert.
Mm-hmm.
And then another one. I mean, even Storm with her ultra confidence and all that. She's also sort of in that boat, right? I don't know what Mert's excuse is, other than I kind of think that it's a little bit of Ed's personality that Mert represents him a little bit in the world,
Right.
Or at least part of him. But he's also very clearly and specifically, maybe in the interview you'll talk to him about this. Talked about how one of the mindsets he gets into when he writes people like Storm and Elminster is you're talking about people who have lived for centuries, and when you're 500, 700, 1,000 years old, some of the things and the way you talk and the way you behave and the way you deal with other people, some of those social graces just sort of go out the window. You don't care anymore. How many times have you had the stupid conversation trying to talk to the noble who's too concerned about politeness and all that kind of stuff? And they're just sort of over it.
Right.
And I think the taboos and what have you that deal with sexuality and what have you sort of fall into that line as well. And so maybe they're just a little bit more open with those kinds of things because they're over it and they don't care anymore.
Yeah, well, and I personally like open, but I'd prefer it to be open rather than eye rolls and harumphs and, oh my God, I can't believe you said that to me sort of stuff. That's just like, okay, if we're going to set this up, let's actually do that. But I know that they're working within constraints too as to, the age groups that they want to include in the book and all that other stuff.
Yeah. I hear you. And now a special treat. Everyone gets to hear Chapter 1 of Barry Elminster Deep, read by Ed Greenwood himself, the man with the greatest storytelling voice ever.
Chapter 1, Kneeling to a Goddess. As he directed Amaroon's borrowed body to pad cautiously through a pale white labyrinth of moonlit trees, Elminster felt himself trembling. This almost had to be a trap after all this time, yet Nay, it was her, his mistress. It was. He could feel her. He knew that feeling. could never forget the touch of her mind on his. This was Mistra, the vivid blue mists of power swirling around the edges of his mind. A sharp stick underfoot hurt his, well, Rune's, bare feet, and El sank to all fours to crawl like a beast. He tingled with eager haste and had to remind himself to look for what peril that might be a prowl in the king's forest. Halting on a tree-cloaked ridge in the rolling, deepening woods north of the cabin, one hand raised like a questing cat's paw, he listened hard. He heard distant stirrings of brush to the northeast, probably well across the way of the dragon. Then silence, broken by a brief, faint hooting even farther westward. Still and silent, Amaroon's dancer's body poised like a statue, El waited. Long enough for even a lazy hunter to become impatient, he held still, but nothing else moved that he could hear. And the sleekly muscled body he was occupying had far better hearing than what he'd grown used to in recent centuries. Some of his excitement washed into her sleeping mind, at rest in one dim corner of the brain he steered. Amaroon rose slowly toward wakefulness, her dreams growing restless, as she tasted his eagerness. "You're as giddy as a lass fleeing her first kiss," El reproached himself, as he crawled on down the ferny slope of wet, dead leaves towards a dark bank of old, leaning trees. "Steady, sages, Shadowdale. Where's that world-weary yawning that ye do so well?" Part of him smirked, but through the lacy curtain of his mirth, El fought to quell ever-wilder excitement as he reached the bottom of the slope, only to lose his breath under a thrilling onslaught of fresh nerves as he felt the nearness of Mistra right ahead of him. A weighty taste in the air came from the silent gloom behind a rising old tree that smelled of bear. He didn't even have time for a hint of fear before he saw a dark wall of fur that must be that beast shambling away along the line of trees, afire with Mistress power, just as his own mind was. Blue fire deepened in his brain, bringing certainty. The goddess of all magic was riding the bear's mind, just as he was riding Amaroon's. Before El knew it, the moonlit trees were behind him, and he was crawling into bear-smelling darkness, over muddy, loose stones in a musky earthen den, tapestried in descending roots, and floored with gnawed old bones green with mold. As he crawled on, the ground dropped down into a stony cavern tall enough to stand in, aglow with Mistress Fire. Where two great, keen eyes he'd not seen for long centuries suddenly opened in the air in front of him, stealing away his breath again. Elminster gazed into them, dumbstruck. Floating orbs of silver-blue fire regarded him with love and an excitement to match his own. Eyes he'd feared he'd never see again. Amaroon's body lacked the feel for the art that his aching old frame had possessed, but strain though he might, he could sense nothing false about what loomed before him. This was Mistra, though the heat in his mind remained a whispering echo of her full power. Yet Our Lady of Mystery could easily hold back, cloaking her divine might to seem less than she was, and often, usually, did so. The eyes of deepening silver-blue fire were linked by softly coursing threads of that same radiance, lines like lightnings too gentle to crackle or spit, to things strewn among rocks on the cavern floor. A gauntlet with gems inset in the knuckles, a wand, a ring, other small items still hidden among the stones. "Some blood of my mortal self spilled on these trifles of art in the time before I became Mistra," came the warm whisper of the goddess, both in his head and filling the cavern as if she were awakening and purring languor right beside his ear. "When you came nigh, El, the nearness of your mind alerted me. I am preoccupied much now." "He collected these things when ye were midnight?" El blurted, trembling in a sudden chaos of wanting to know so much, yet not knowing what he dared ask. Her love, or at least fondness, was in his head and all around him, but something was subtly different in it a distance that had not been there once, or rather one that had grown since midnight had ascended to replace the Mistra his far younger self had first touched and tasted. Gone was the Mistra whose mind would long ago have merged with his to let them converse wordlessly, thoughts flashing. Something was rising in him, something urgent. Before he quite knew what it was, he felt a flash of confusion and wonder, alarm, strangled by awe. Amarun Almar had awakened. "I did," the Lady of Magic replied, as if nothing had happened, though fond regard washed out of her bright silver-blue fire into Amarun, causing a mental turmoil of astonished pleasure tinged with bewilderment. "The bear keeps them safe here, and I see through his eyes and guide him. It is good you came to me, El. I have many unfinished tasks for you." "Lady?" Roon dared to blurt then. "Who are you?" "I," the fire behind the eyes replied as tenderly as any gently drawn sword, "am Mistra. I am magic." That last word became a thunderclap that raced away into unseen distances, only to return a rolling echo of deep, teeth-chattering force that made small stones fall and patter in the bear's den, and the living roots groan and murmur all around them. "I am the fire in all things." That whisper came soft and calm, uttered only in the depths of their shared mind. Then Mistra seemed to shake herself and added, "More than ever, El, I need your service. You, I can truly trust, where so many others have turned from me or fallen. I can coerce, of course, but I will no longer make that mistake of lesser gods. The work of slaves is nigh worthless. For deeds to have true and lasting meaning, they must be done willingly. Elminster Almar, El mine, are you still mine? Are you with me?" "As ever," Elminster burst out, finding himself on the choking edge of tears in an instant. "Goddess, command me!" Blue fire flooded through him, leaving him gasping, overwhelmed by Mistress' pleased satisfaction. "You must be my roving hands, skulking alone," she said, eyes flashing with resolve, showing power enough to make Amarun's mind cower. "I charge you to preserve magic wherever and whenever you can, keeping to the shadows as much as possible. Bold confrontations and invoking my name are clumsy marks of pride I would fain put behind me forever. So, El, be my, forgive me, Amarun, my silent shadow." Amarun fought to make her lips gasp. El was too distracted to relinquish control over them. He felt amusement washing through his mind on tides of blue fire as Rune managed her gasp, then gave him a rueful mental shove as she yielded her mouth back to him. It was some moments later before he managed to reply, "Lady, I will." "Employ disguises. Be the thief you once so ably were in Hastarl. Steal and copy magic, and then hide the copies so that whatever befalls the originals, my art will survive for those yet unborn." "Lady," Elminster repeated, "I will. Recruit new chosen, and gather them here for me to confer with. I need many, and they must be different from my daughters and from each other, for that kinship was another misstep. Yet we both know how rarely the needed loyalty and strength are found together. And above all, I must have those I can trust." El nodded, remembering Kelvin and Samaster, Laerol, and too many elven ladies who were all so willing, yet had faded so swiftly under the ravages of too much art. Betrayals, defiances, independence, and weaknesses. Gone now, all of them. Gone. His Alasra, fled and mad somewhere, brain burned by the roaring blue fire that was not Mistra, the plague of wild fury that had snuffed out the lives of thousands in a blazing instant, and many more in the days and seasons that had followed. "Lady," he said huskily, "I will. Continue what you have done so well for so long. Preserve and strengthen the art. not magic bestowed by others, but magic worked by the caster's own craft and knowledge.
Lady, I've done that for so long, El told her truthfully, that I do not know if I could now refrain from doing so. It is what I do. It is. Yet the fall of Azun heralded your newest task. It is time to do what Storm and Dove have both suggested. By any means you deem best, becoming their head or turning their leaders to my service, recruit Cormyr's wizards of war. They must become the ready allies, helping hands, and spies for all my chosen. All my chosen? Ah, Storm and Alassar, of course. If there were more, and Mistra desired him to know of them, she would reveal them. She was right, of course. If he was to manage any of these tasks, he sorely needed new allies. With his own body lost to him, Alassar crazed, Storm's magic all but gone, and the work already far more than he and Storm could handle. Soon enough, you'll again have a body of your own, Mistra murmured among El's racing thoughts. She was reading them, of course, and in the meantime, the goddess whispered, I can aid the one you have. You have been sorely wounded in my service. The silver-blue fires changed, and in the mind they were sharing, Amarun recoiled in fear. The floating eyes flared larger, brighter, and nearer. Embrace me, Mistra commanded. Somewhat warily, with Amarun on the verge of whimpering at the back of their shared mind, an image of her fearful, staring eyes flaring to outshine Mistra's huge orbs, Elminster stepped forward and spread his arms wide. The shield-sized eyes of silver-blue drifted together, merging in smooth silence right in front of him and flaring into silver lightning that shocked through him. His arms flew apart convulsively and then tightened again around the lightning as if it were something solid he could crush. Not that Elminster was thinking of crushing anything, or thinking at all. He was too busy screaming in pain. The high, throat-stripping shriek of a young female dancer, lost in agony and horror, spat out of him into the night as lightning slammed through him, his every hair standing on end like a straining dagger, snapped back out of him, then roared back into him again. It was as if a thousand spears thrust through him, tore back out, then thrust right back in repeatedly through the same gaping wounds. Elminster was dimly aware of falling to his knees and shuddering helplessly. He was caught in the bright spears of lightning, unable to collapse onto his face, unable to do anything. Every time the lightning snarled out of him, they took life with them, vitality that was not returned when they stormed in again. Amarun was sobbing, or trying to, but her body could not breathe, could no longer make a sound. Her brain was awash in roaring silver fire, flames of power that thundered through her mind and might well have destroyed it had Elminster not been grimly fighting to stay himself, to cling to what was Elminster of Shadowdale, amid the hungry fires of a goddess. Around him, blue fire was being beaten back by silver flames, flames that circled him and then darted into him. Elminster tried to scream, but all that came out was a strangled squeak. Mistra, if it was Mistra, had drained much energy from his borrowed body, but was now at work on steadying his mind, forcing back the roiling blue fires that had lurked there for nigh 100 years. There, my champion, Mistra whispered as tenderly as any mother. Go forth renewed. Greater and more magic you can now work, without madness coming upon you. But not an unlimited amount. I cannot do more. Go now, until next we meet. Silver fire left him then, leaving only chill darkness. Elminster stood forlorn, blind in the darkness. Something soft and tender stroked his face and arm, turning him and leading him back, out and up, stumbling over unseen things underfoot, once more into the moonlight. Weak and dazed, reeling with Amarun cowering in mute terror in a corner of their shared mind, Elminster shivered in the night. Bare and chilled, feeling sick and empty. Kiss of Mistra, half of Rune's energy must be gone. He staggered up rises and down slopes, through countless trees. The way was not long, but he would have been lost
had a tiny silver star not guided him until the dark bulk of the little lodge loomed out of the night. He leaned against its front wall beside the door, shuddering, until he could master his breathing enough to stand upright and square her shoulders. Amaroon was still drawn into herself, but El could put the pain and horror of the lightning firmly behind him and take satisfaction in the healing that had been done to him by his goddess. His Mistra. Aye, Mistra was alive and in the realm still. A part of him wanted to shout that to the stars above, to bellow it until folk came awake in their beds in Suzail to sit up listening. And a part of him wanted to keep it so secret that not even the young nobleman inside the hut would begin to suspect it, let alone Manshun or any other wizard of power. Elminster threw back his head, drew in a deep breath, and smiled at the tiny silver flash of farewell that winked out in the darkness above his nose. Then he eased open the door with a fingertip and stepped inside as quietly as he could. The hearth was dim, almost out, but someone had lit the brazier tray fixed in its spark shield frame behind the door. Its dancing glow fell upon blankets, frozen in the usual twisted chaos left behind when sleepers arise. And it fell upon Storm Silverhand, her shirt-clad body bent back in a graceful bow on the floor. Someone had hog-tied her to a leg of the table, and her hair was over her face. She lay unmoving, dead, or senseless. She'd been bound with an Arclast belt. The door slammed behind Elminster. He spun around, managing to quell Rune's instinctive urge to leap back and away. He might need to be close. As he'd expected, he faced a half-dressed Lord Elclast Delcastle, who waved his sword threateningly. Behind its bright edge, and above the burning brazier, the young nobleman held the coffer in which Storm had been carrying Elminster's ashes. Arclast's eyes, as he glared at El, were like two dagger points. "Luckily for my Amaroon's sake," he snapped, "you seem unaware that even fine upstanding nobles of Cormyr learn a few tawdry secrets of the realm, and lack scruples in exploiting them. The uses of Darfly sting essence, for instance. It brings on instant topple-on-your-face sleep at the slightest scratch, and can be found on the heads of the takedown arrows that High Knights of Cormyr hide in the same spot in every royal hunting lodge across the realm. Sleep that takes even legendary silver-haired bards blessed by the gods, it seems." Elminster sighed and shook his head, and then he lunged back as the bright tip of Arclast's sword hissed past his throat. Inside the mind they shared, El threw all his exasperation at Amaroon, who spasmed like a speared fish, sent fury back at him, and stared at Arclast. "Your ashes," the nobleman hissed, shaking the coffer. "I'll destroy them if you don't surrender Amaroon to me." He bent into a lunge that kept his sword up and menacing Elminster as he lowered the box into the flames of the brazier. They flared up and crackled, right on cue. "Wizard, get out of her right now, or you die." He flicked his blade so its tip pointed at Storm's throat, where she lay with her head on the floor, silver hair fallen across her face. "And so does she."
Woo!
And here ends chapter one.
And if you want to hear more, you'll have to go out and buy the book.
Well, that's episode 181. You can always email us at thetomeshow@gmail.com or visit the forums at gamershavenpodcast.com or call the Tome's biz line at 919-BIZ-TOME, BIZTOME, with your thoughts, questions, or comments for an upcoming episodes.
Next month is likely to be Gen Con crazy with episodes, although we may discuss some of the Neverwinter book that should be coming out next month as well, or maybe early September. We'll see how it all comes together. So be sure to call up and let us know your thoughts or questions regarding any of that stuff. We'll also be finally concluding our contest and announcing the winners next month, which is I guess, about a month or so later than we expected. But turns out the baby came a little earlier than expected, and scheduling suddenly became a little bit more difficult.
And also, if you enjoyed this book talk, be sure to consider joining us at the Tomes Book Club. Right now we're reading the Erebus Kale Trilogy by Paulus Kemp, and we're finishing the second book now. Or, we just finished the second book. and we'll be finishing the third book at the end of August. After that, it'll be my pick, and I chose The Godcatcher by Aaron Evans. We'd love for you to join us live or with calls on those episodes as well. That's 919-BIZ-TOME.
Before we say goodbye, don't forget to consider checking out the Tome's Amazon store for products discussed on the show and more. The show gets part of the proceeds, and that helps keep us on the air. Links for things mentioned in the show can be found in the show notes on the website at thetomeshow.com. And now it's time for Tracy to unleash her sexy voice. Go!
Yeah, I don't think that's happening. This has been episode 181, the sexiest episode ever, looking at Bury Elminster Deep on
The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome.
I'm on the wall.